From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. This is George Norrie, and it's Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, though, special open lines, so get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Boy, this country is getting hit with incredible heat these days. 50 firefighters overcome by heat Friday while battling a huge fire in Jersey City, New Jersey, according to emergency officials. Blistering heat wave continued to send temperatures soaring across the country. Power outages, water shortages, and the temperature is not the only thing getting hot these days. If you've been outside, you may have noticed tempers are flaring as well. The hot weather does a lot to our behavior. There's road rage, air rage, fan rage at sporting events, and now we have heat rage. It's not new. It's actually part of our language. Tempers flare, anger simmer, and boils over. And, of course, these are times where people just become hotheads. Mitch Batchwas, of course, earthchangesmedia.com with us. Mitch, what's going on? Why is the country all so steamy hot these days?
Well, the earth has seen it before. Now, when we talk about record temperatures, we're talking about 120 years. So when you see a news brief that comes out that says, record temperatures, it's true. Of temperatures recorded. You look beyond that when you start to get in paleogeography, mm-hmm. Then you see that the Earth has seen this many times before with larger swings of hot and cold and much hotter and much colder. That doesn't help anybody who's out there today. I remember about a decade ago, another heat wave had come, and especially in the east, in the northeast, New York in particular, a lot of people, especially the elderly, had really become in critical condition. Some even perished. About 12 years ago, it happened in France, similar situation, except it was closer to 1,000 people. It is something that people need to be very, very careful for. The sun has been real hot. It is finally climbing into some M-class flares. There's certainly a correlation. Filament, charged particles coming from filament and coronal mass ejections and coronal holes, those are not often mentioned. Mostly we hear about solar flares. But the radiation is still very, very high, and we get these solar storms all playing a role in what's going on. The oceans are warming, coming from the bottom up. Where this heat, of course, it heats up our atmosphere, but there's a correlation with the Earth's core. Just as a human, the Earth, as a living entity, if you will, when it gets too hot, it sweats. And when it sweats, that's when it releases some boiling magma up through what we call mantle plumes, and then it heats the ocean, and here we are.
Right, and we are here in a big way, Mitch. By the way, how are you feeling? How's your back?
Not good. It's affecting quite a bit of my life, of course, with my family. And it's what really concerns me is it's I think to a lesser or greater degree, it's affecting my work. As you know, George, you have me on all the time. We've known each other for years now. That you really can't find the information that I can bring to you. I go right to the source, and a lot of stuff does not get covered in the mainstream. You get it firsthand. And because of my back, I'm not haven't been able to stay on top of things as much, and it's actually kind of hitting some into some finances. I'm a little worried about Earth Changes Media. We have some great people that support us, and we need some help right now. If you go to earthchangesmedia.com, up in the right corner, I think, you can find a place if you can help us out through this time.
Well, you stay
strong. George, I've had two injections already, about a month apart. One was for my joints in the back, and the other was for nerves. Neither one have worked. My next third and last, they can only allow three spinal injections, is on August 2nd, and if that doesn't work, then then I have to look at some.
All right. Well, I tell you what we're going to do. I want to put you on hold. I want Tom to give you the name and phone number of a doctor we just had on this week from Seattle, who's an expert in back and back surgery, and he says do not get the surgery. So let's get you in touch with him, Mitch, and Mitch's website, earthchangesmedia.com. Whatever we can do to help you, Mitch, you let us know. Drinking water could be contaminated with methane gas and chemicals due to fracking, according to water company experts in the United Kingdom. What happens here, too? Water UK, which represents all major UK water suppliers, said the shale gas extractions, the method posed as a threat, if not carefully planned and carried out, causes these problems. It also warned that fracking's huge use of water could cause shortages in areas of low supply in England. Fracking, short of hydraulic fracturing, it's called, involves drilling deep underground and releasing a high-pressure mix of water, sand, and hundreds of chemicals to crack rocks and release gas stored inside. The confessed Boston Strangler's DNA was on the body of a woman suspected to be one of his victims decades ago. A lab has matched DNA recovered from the body of Mary Sullivan in 1964 with that of her suspected killer, the confessed Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo. The 19-year-old Sullivan was assaulted and strangled to death in her apartment in Boston. DeSalvo recanted his admissions after confessing to the crime. He was never convicted of any of them. He was stabbed to death in 1973 in prison, serving a life term for unrelated assault charges. In India, the tragedy continues, of course, with those children, 23 of them, who died eating. Indian police suspect that India's worst outbreak of mass food poisoning in years was caused by cooking oil that had been kept in a container previously used to store pesticides. Unbelievable, horrible story there. 23 children dead. America pulling out its economic malaise, they say, slowly but surely, according to the Moody's Investors Service rating agency. Moody's has raised its outlook on U.S. debt to stable, shedding the negative outlook that it has maintained for nearly 2 years. So that's pretty good news right there. The first trial of stem cells produced from a patient's own body has been approved by the Japanese government. Stem cells can come from any part of the body, from the nerve to the bone to skin, and they are touted as the future of medicine. Researchers in Japan will use the cells to attempt to treat a form of blindness. So how about that? Well, it's time for our weekly update from Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, are we still getting a lot of reports these days?
Well, I don't know which way to turn, George, when I'm choosing reports to share with the Coast listeners, but first things first, I heard your announcement, I think, a couple nights ago about progressing negotiations between you and Premier, and it looks like you're going to be around for a while. Boy, that's
long great. Time, Peter. We wrapped it up this week.
Great news for the program. Great news for your listeners. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I've had a whole bunch of reports tonight already. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 8:30 p.m. tonight, George. A gentleman and his mother were sitting out on the outdoor dining area of the pizza establishment they operate, and they saw a tubular craft, clearly metallic in appearance, about the diameter, its length was equal to about the diameter of a full moon. They said it was very, very clearly visible in a clear night sky, streaked across the sky above their heads. It covered about 60 degrees of sky in, they estimated, 5 seconds. So it was obviously not a satellite, almost certainly not an aircraft. Very, very interesting sighting. Had another interesting sighting. This is less than an hour ago. Livingston, Virginia, a former air traffic controller, he identifies himself as that, sent a written report about an object he saw tonight near that city, Livingston. I don't know where that is in Virginia, but he saw a rectangular craft with four white lights at the corners of it, and he heard it. He estimates it was below 1,000 or 10,000 feet, flight level 100, I guess that is. And he said he's never seen anything like it. It clearly did not have, was not exhibiting federally required standard lighting for an aircraft flying at night. Don't know what it was, and about 20 minutes ago, I took a report from a gentleman, sounds like a very clear-thinking, very sober-minded gentleman in Phoenix, Arizona. He's in western Phoenix. He was looking to the northwest from his home, and he saw two clearly self-luminous blue shafts of light hovering motionless in the night sky. Suddenly, they started accelerating and went in different directions. If anybody in Phoenix this evening saw those, I'd welcome a call or a written report from any witness. Last night, North Seattle, this is about 8 or 10 miles north of the Seattle Space Needle.
Okay.
The gentleman standing outside saw a rectangular craft, daylight sighting, George. He said it was bigger than the full moon in the night sky.
That's huge.
Streaking across the sky. And at about the same time, a gentleman in Bessie, Oklahoma, I believe it is, a retired public servant there, saw yet more of these orange objects, fireballs, call them what you will, floating directly overhead. He said, if I remember his report correctly, he said they're about three times the size of a full moon in the night sky. And he said he didn't want to get involved because he'd been a public servant. One of the most remarkable things he's ever seen in his life, but he balked at submitting a written report. So that's a good report that we're going to lose. I'm pleased to have an opportunity to share it with the Coast listeners. In any event, this July may set a record for the volume of reports, and they're just pouring in from all over the country. Most of all, and I'll close with this, interestingly, just 2 days ago, I submitted an article to Roger Marsh, who edits the MUFON UFO Journal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a journal they publish every month. I've been writing an article for them every month, except for one over the last year or so. And I chose to talk about all of the sightings that we're getting from northeastern South Carolina, Horry County specifically. The reports are just pouring in from there about orange and red lights, apparently distant off the coast of South Carolina. I've mentioned it briefly before on appearances on coast, but nobody, as far as I know, has any explanation for these things, George. And I'd like to put out an appeal to anybody in South Carolina to submit reports if they see these lights. It's a very interesting phenomenon to us.
And Peter's website, of course, UFOcenter.com. He's with the National UFO Reporting Center, of course. And, of course, you know paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren from Puerto Rico may have the remains of an alien in a jar. We'll talk about that. Joshua investigated. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren has been spending a lot of time in Puerto Rico, chasing all kinds of stories, including, of course, the possibility of an alien in a jar. Josh, welcome back. And by the way, get up to our website because Josh has sent us some photos of this very strange situation. How are you, Josh?
You know, George, I feel like I'm living in the Twilight Zone, honestly. I mean, as if all of these reports of UFOs buzzing around the island and strange creatures being seen weren't enough. Now, as you may have seen, there's international news about dead bodies vanishing from cemeteries here in Puerto Rico. One in particular in a little town called Garabo, we're talking about 40 corpses have, you know, just vanished from this small mountain cemetery. And I have talked to some locals who literally believe something akin to a biblical resurrection may be taking place, and that these dead bodies are literally getting up in the middle of the night and walking out of the cemetery. And the funny thing is, there are only really two options here. Either one, these bodies are being resurrected, which I highly doubt, or two, somebody is taking them. And the question then becomes, are the aliens that have been seen in the area and all of the UFOs to blame? Are they abducting dead bodies now, just like the live people? Or Are there humans stealing these bodies for some type of nefarious, dark, ritualistic purposes? And either way, the repercussions are creepy, to say the least.
Well, let me tell you, Josh, you've been doing a great job out there in Puerto Rico. How long are you going to be out there?
I'll be here till September, and then I'm heading back to my laboratory and museum up in Asheville, North Carolina, working on some projects there for the fall. And then I'll probably be coming back down here in the winter, but I'm working on some TV projects that might take me off onto some other locations. So I'll just kind of be bouncing around a lot, but the work here never seems finished because I just find that something is definitely culminating here. And, you know, that's what I've been hearing for years and years. There is this sort of growing sense that something is building up around Puerto Rico. And, of course, we're right here in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. And of course, when some of these stories arise, I have to be very careful about poking around. I mean, for example, let's take this story about all these dead bodies that have disappeared in the cemetery. Did you actually see that news story when it came out, George?
Yes, I sure did.
Yeah, and of course, my initial instinct was to jump in a car and drive to this place and start snooping around. You know me, you know, I'm like the kids in Scooby-Doo, right? But the problem is, I imagine that if people are stealing these bodies from this cemetery for ritualistic purposes, the types of people who are doing that probably would not take so kindly to an outsider like me, an obvious gringo popping up there and asking too many questions, and I might end up, you know, in some type of a dungeon ritual myself. So I contacted a friend of mine because you may recall recently we were talking some about the magical practices on the island, Jordan.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I contacted my friend who is a Santero. He is a type of priest here on the island, but he practices what is called IFA, which he says is all about positivity. He always dresses in white, and he doesn't associate himself with anything negative. But he says there are a lot of people around this particular area up in the mountains there that practice what is called palo. Now, just to sort of clarify things a bit, in Puerto Rico, you know, obviously most of the island here is beautiful. It's welcoming, especially around the coast. It's very tourist friendly. But when you go inland, there are some really high mountains with these secluded little villages. And when you go there, you get this feeling that, you know, people are very suspicious of you. And it is a little bit unsettling to go there as an outsider. In these little villages, some of the people who practice this thing called palo, they incorporate human remains into their rituals. And essentially, if indeed this is what is happening in this particular cemetery, which has been there for over 100 years, and now all of a sudden these bodies are vanishing, apparently they would be going there to take these bodies, believing that they can therefore entrap the spirit of the dead person. And what they would essentially do is take these bodies and put them, sort of stuff them into these little cauldrons called calderos, and then wrap a chain around them. And at that point, they are symbolically trapping the spirit, and then they would feed it. They would feed it by pouring in blood of various animals or alcohol or tobacco, depending upon the scenario. And then they would use this sort of relationship, if you will, to cause the spirit to go out and enact their dark evil bidding, right? And as long as the remains are chained up in this cauldron, then the spirit cannot do anything other than obey its master. But if that chain is ever broken, well, then the spirit is going to strike at whoever happens to be nearest. And so probably somewhere out there on this island, you've got cauldrons that are stuffed with human bodies, and there are all kinds of weird things being poured into them. And somebody out there is trying to work on, as my friend said, some extremely powerful, troubling stuff. And I think it's so odd that that's happening right around one of the areas where this UFO activity has really been spiking up. And I wonder, whatever these UFOs are they concerned about the dark practices that are happening at that part of the island? Or is there something about the UFO presence here that is inspiring these magicians to do these rituals?
Interesting. Stay with us, Josh. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll talk more with you about the strange things going on in Puerto Rico. Later on, we'll take paranormal calls with Joshua P. Warren right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're with paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren. One of his works, Pet Ghosts, Animal Encounters from Beyond the Grave. He's in Puerto Rico where all kinds of strange things happening. Josh, let's talk a little bit more about this alien in a jar. What do you think about it personally?
Well, this is a great story, and let me tell you how all this unfolded. Of course, I have been just astounded by how easy it is to find people around this island who have had these broad daylight sightings of UFOs. And yet it seemed like I could not find a good photograph. And, you know, everybody's running around with cell phones. I thought somebody's got to have a picture out there. And so I fortuitously walked into a restaurant and struck up a conversation one day and heard about a guy who took a picture on his cell phone that had never been published. And I ended up meeting with him. He's 34 years old. I'll just give his first name out. His name is Lewis. And he is a scientist, actually. As a matter of fact, he works for a major company. If I said the name, you would know it. And he also, interestingly enough, works as a genetically modified seed technician. And I think that's just kind of weird because, as you well know, there are lots of conspiracies about that whole realm. And so it's kind of weird to have a guy who works in that associated with a UFO scenario. But nonetheless, he has an uncle who owns a large farm out in the area called or near the area called Lajas, which is sort of the center for a lot of the weird stuff, where a lot of the government experimentation has been done on monkeys, where you have the UFO lagoon, where you have these strange military bases that are all unmarked and everybody's plain clothes and nobody knows exactly what branch they're with and what they're doing. So here he was driving to his uncle's farm May of last year at 9:30 in the morning. And right as he arrived at the farm, he noticed that all the cattle were flipping out and running in different directions, and he'd never seen that before. And so he pulled out his cell phone, and he started snapping pictures of the cattle. And it was after he'd snapped a few shots that he looked at his pictures and said, "What the heck is that?" And he gave me permission to post this picture. In fact, I need some help from the listeners because my team and I have been analyzing this. We can't figure out what it is. It's posted right now at joshuapwarren.com. There is no period after the P at joshuapwarren.com. It's this black saucer-shaped anomaly. And the weirdest thing is that it looks like it has two arms on either side of it, one to the top side of the saucer shape and on the other to the bottom side of the saucer shape, which gives it an almost cyclonic sort of sense. And yet the arms don't seem to be attached. It's a very, very weird thing. And I mean, I'm telling you, we've used a lot of technology. We still are not certain what this is. But I was immediately, of course, determined to go to that area and explore as much as possible to see what I could find and to see if anybody had had an even closer encounter.
Does it look like something that was dead?
I'm sorry, what's that, George?
Does it look like something dead?
Well, the thing that was in the sky, actually, it's just, you know, some type of an anomaly. We're not certain what the heck that we're looking at. But when I went to that area and I started asking around, I started talking to people who believe they'd actually seen UFOs and on the ground and aliens coming out of the UFOs. And this was what was really intriguing to me, because it's one thing when you have stories of some unusual craft or some weird light. It's another thing when you have stories about people seeing what they believe are little alien creatures.
Right.
And so I started looking around this road called Highway 303, which is well known as the extraterrestrial highway. And a lot of people had claimed they'd been seeing aliens in this area. So I ended up walking into a little bar. There's not much around this area. I walk into the little bar, and I'm trying to communicate with the people inside, and none of them spoke English very well. So, and I'm still trying to learn Spanish.
Right, and they're trying to figure out who the heck is this guy.
Yeah, this is not the easiest topic to discuss and with broken communication skills. And so I was trying to explain to them, what my interests were. And they immediately realized, I'm talking about UFOs. But as we continued trying to discuss this, I looked over and I saw way off to the left side of the bar a glass container that didn't look like it was holding any type of drinkable alcohol. It looked out of place. And so I said, what's that? And the barkeep turns around and he looks at the jar and he looks back at me and he grins and he says, "Alien." And I said, what are you talking about? And he says, "Alien." And he says, Memento. So he goes and he gets somebody else who speaks English better. And this guy comes back and he says, "Oh, you want to see the jar, huh?" And I said, "Well, yeah, what's in it?" And he told me that the man who owned the bar was a big UFO enthusiast. And he always told everybody that, if he could get access to any evidence of UFOs, that he'd love to use it in his bar, put it on display, do something with it. And one day, a local farmer came walking in with this jar. And the farmer told the owner of the bar that the night before, there had been a big, bright UFO that had landed on his property. And the next day, when he went out there poking around on the property, he found a dead little alien creature of some sort. And he put it into a jar of rubbing alcohol, and the thing almost immediately sort of shriveled up and almost deflated, it was very weird how the body of this thing supposedly reacted to being in the rubbing alcohol. So he brings it in there, and he gives it to the guy who owned the bar, and the guy who owned the bar was obviously ecstatic to have this thing. I have no idea if there was any money that changed hands, and he proudly put this thing on the bar. And then 9 months ago, the owner was killed very tragically in a motorcycle accident. Yeah. And so, and of course, the people who are there at the bar are still just now trying to deal with, the death of the previous bar owner. And they took this jar down. And they would let me take pictures of it, but they would not let me open it or get any closer look inside. And I tried to explain to these guys, I said, "Well, look, I'm a researcher. I have a museum in Asheville, North Carolina, the Asheville Mystery Museum, and I will pay you, if that's what is required, to be able to examine this thing, or I will even, better yet, offer to buy it from you."
You would love to get your mitts on that thing, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you know it. I mean, that would just be one of the star attractions. Well, obviously, at the museum, I already have the wooden alien statue that was in Art Bell's studio. So this would be a nice little addition to that display. And they said that because that this was a prized possession of the bar owner, who is no longer with us, that it has taken on a new sort of sentimental meaning to the family, and that they would never, ever sell it because it was just something that he treasured so much. And I realized I was sort of, treading into some sensitive subjects there, and so I didn't want to seem insensitive or push the matter too far. But you can go there to coasttocoastam.com, and you can see these photographs. And what you'll see is that it's very difficult to tell what's in this jar. It does look like something fleshy, but for all I know, it could be made out of rubber. It could be some other type of creature. I mean, obviously, there are farms around. Could this be a pig or even a monkey, for that matter? I mean, it's possible. I just am not in a position to to be able to pop this thing open and really take a good look at it yet, but I'm still hoping I get to do that. And so you can imagine, here we have this great, anomalous photo I was talking about there, showing the saucer-like object. And then right down the road, this farmer has this supposed alien in a body, alien body in a jar that's sitting on the shelf. All of these fascinating little pieces are falling into place. And I'm just not sure what we're dealing with, but there are also reports of weird creatures that have been seen in that same area, creatures that don't neatly fit into any category, not like your typical chupacabra, animals that have characteristics that I've never heard about before.
I've got in my office in Los Angeles, I'm going to have Tom take a picture of it, an alien in a jar, but I think it's made out of rubber. I want you to take a look at it, Josh. I've never opened the thing up. He's in there floating, and it's about, he's about 10 inches tall, a pretty good size one. I suspect this one's a little smaller.
Well, you know, this particular jar, it's kind of a roundish shaped jar. I would estimate that it may be about 10 to 12 inches in diameter, and it might be about that same height. And what you see is that the fluid inside is slightly discolored, and it just kind of looks like this sort of mash of various folds of skin. And it's difficult to look at it and to pick out any particular alien-like shape. So the one that you have, I imagine, probably looks like a little humanoid body. Is that right, George?
Yes, sure is.
Yeah. See, this one, you just really can't see that shape anymore because, you know, it's obvious that whatever was put in there originally, if it was rubber or if it was flesh, whatever was originally put in there has certainly deflated. And it's possible that one of the listeners will be able to look at it and sort of try to extract from this weird fleshy bulge something that could take us closer to its original form. But when you consider these other odd creature stories from the area, it could be one of those. I'll give you an example. Just a few days ago, I was told by a very, very credible source about a man who is a captain who's very well known around here, and he has a nice ship, or a nice boat, I guess you'd say, and he takes people back and forth between the western part of the island of Puerto Rico and this little island called Isla Mona, which is about 30 miles off the west coast. Okay. And in order to be able to transport people like that, I mean, you have to have a lot of paperwork, a lot of insurance. You have to be a very responsible person. There are a lot of government filters you have to go through. So this guy comes across as a very, very rational man. And he owns a lot of land. And he said that just a few days ago, he was on his property. And mind you, this fella has lived here his entire life. He was on his property, and he looked over and saw something that he could not explain. There was a creature that was, it wasn't huge. It was probably no more than about 3 feet. But the weird thing is that it was a very glossy black color. And it sort of transitioned back and forth between four legs and standing on two legs. It had a face that didn't look like anything he'd ever seen. He said it certainly didn't look like a dog or a cat or a monkey, and he had trouble even describing what it looked like. But the thing that really stuck out the most was that this creature had these glowing blue-green eyes. Now, this is during broad daylight, and so it's very weird when you hear about a creature with glowing eyes during the sunny day here in the middle of summer in Puerto Rico. But as he was looking at this creature right before his very eyes, it just vanished as if somebody had flipped the switch and it was gone. And within 5 minutes, a white vehicle from the Department of Natural Resources popped up and there were people walking around scouring the roadsides and his property with instruments, and they would not talk to him about what they were looking for.
What is it about this region that seems to be so active?
Well, you know, here's what I've been thinking about, because this is the really integral question, you know, why this place? And to me, the most sensible explanation is that right exactly where the UFO lagoon is located, which is, if you have to pick one center of activity, it's got to be that UFO lagoon. Exactly where that lagoon is located is in the hills that are the oldest land in the entire Caribbean region. So that means 190 million years ago, according to geologists, when there was nothing but ocean here, the very first places where land began to peak up out of the ocean were exactly where that lagoon is. So if these UFOs have been coming here for maybe millions of years, because we have no idea how advanced these beings may be, you know, time is something that we can't truly even comprehend with our tiny little human brains. If they have been coming here for millions of years, then when they visited this part of planet Earth, if they wanted to land or to check out any dry terra firma, that was the only spot that existed. And so if they went to that spot and actually set up their very first base in this whole area at that spot, then it might make sense that they have continued using that base all this time, and that you know, nothing has changed in terms of its usefulness. Now there's more land available, but that was the spot where they were established. And of course, because that this has been a UFO base for all these perhaps millions of years, well, once governments evolved, like, for example, our U.S. government, then we naturally wanted to sort of center some of our research and forces around this exotic technology to learn about it. And I also think it's quite intriguing that just a few miles off the coast, you have the Puerto Rico Trench, which is the deepest point in the entire Atlantic Ocean, the second deepest point in the world. It's almost 30,000 feet deep. You could almost put all of Mount Everest inside. And there is no telling what potential there may be for hiding things in a trench or in an area that's so deep. And, of course, a lot of these UFOs are seen going in and out of the water, which is why they're referred to as USOs, unidentified submerged objects. And so it could just be that, you know, the first step in this being such an active spot was that it was just the oldest land around.
Those were incredible cases, too. Those underwater submerged UFO cases, Josh, are just riveting, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've talked to so many fishermen who have seen those. And, in fact, I went out on the ocean with a fisherman recently who'd had a number of sightings. And as we were going down the coast, he was pointing out to me some of these strange military bases that you can see from the ocean, but you can't go over there. They're restricted access, and you're not even really supposed to photograph them. But, of course, you know, I took some pictures. And he said that there are submarines that the fishermen know about that go into the interior of the island through underground tunnels right up toward that UFO lagoon. And
that's
so
amazing.
These fishermen can be out there on the ocean at night and see these big bright lights under the water, but they're afraid of them. They don't know if there's a submarine there or if it's a USO, but there are plenty of them either way.
Josh, we're going to come back. We're going to take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.